I am here with Robert Kaplan. Robert, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I've been a fan of your work for many years. I think like half of humanity, I was first introduced to you when you wrote that rather shocking article in The Atlantic in 1994, The Coming Anarchy, which I think was probably the most read piece in the magazine for quite some time. I don't know if it's been supplanted by anything in recent years, but that article was everywhere.
Yes. See, remember, it was the 1990s. So it was photocopied. It was the most photocopied article of the decade because that was the technology then. Nowadays, you have so many outlets, so many things coming at you, that it's hard for a piece really to rise above the rest, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then you followed it up, if memory serves, with the book-length version, The Ends of the Earth, which I also read at the time. In hardback. So I've been following you for quite some time. Before we jump in and talk about your new book and all manner of thing that worries us, how do you describe your career and your focus as a writer and journalist?
Well, I started out as a journalist at a newspaper in Vermont, the Rutland Daily Herald. And then I bought a one-way ticket to Europe and North Africa. And I traveled the world essentially over the years. And I got bored with conventional journalism, you know, with standard, narrowly focused journalism. When I was in Turkey, I didn't care how many F-15s the Turkish government was going to buy from the United States. I wanted to visit the Museum of Anatolian Civilizations. I thought that would tell me more about Turkey than how many F-15s they were going to buy. So I just gradually emerged out of daily journalism, and I had an editor who really helped me in this regard, William Whitworth, who was the editor of the Atlantic Monthly for 20 years, from 1980 to 2000, and he died last year. Without him, I don't know what I would have done, but he recognized something in me and let me do the kind of writing I wanted to do, which was to incorporate with journalism philosophy, geography, history, literature.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you do that quite eloquently. The new book is Wasteland, A World in Permanent Crisis, which we will get to. But let's start with The Ends of the Earth and how the world looked to you then. Because you, in addition to everything descriptive that is of such interest in your work, you're not shy about prognosticating. And I'm wondering how your view of the future has held up over the last 30-plus years. Because in The Coming Anarchy, and again in the book The Ends of the Earth, you paint a very bleak picture of the future, and you know, it's not too much to say the unraveling on some level of civilization. I remember you were focused more on the way the end of the Cold War would just kind of lift the lid on simmering cultural conflicts, and the way that environmental concerns and urbanization and other, you know, and demographic trends would just lead to fragmentation and disorder. What, if anything, in that view has held up well, and what do you think you got wrong?
Well, the specifics always you get things wrong, but I think the general view is held up well. Remember, these were products of the 1990s. The Coming Anarchy was published in 1994 as an essay. It came out in book form in 1996. That was the heart of the mid-1990s, when the policy elite at famous posh conferences in Davos and elsewhere were predicting a world of liberal humanism. They predicted that Africa, Asia, every place would just follow Eastern Europe into democracy and good governance. And I was traveling around Africa, the Middle East, and other places, and I said, that's not true at all. These places have different histories. They're at a different time in their development, and they're not just following what happened with the collapse of a number of regimes in former communist Eastern Europe. So, I saw a totally different world than the policy elites at the time. And I actually followed it up with another Atlantic essay called Was Democracy Just a Moment?
Yeah.
Which came out in 1997. Again, this is the 1990s, when the whole policy elite bought into the notion that history was over, that there were going to be no more wars. We can just concentrate on stabilizing human rights, etc. And I had a different image. So I would say that my overall prognosis of the world has held up extremely well. I wrote about anarchy in Sierra Leone and Cote d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast, but those were models for what would later happen in Libya, Syria, Iraq, many other places, Burma, then called Burma, now Myanmar, etc. So I think generally it's held up well.
And obviously you wrote certainly the article, Coming Anarchy, in 94, before virtually anyone was on the internet, right? I forget what year we all got on, 96 or something, but obviously before social media and smartphones and the implications of this technology knitting the world together for good or for ill, and largely for ill, is of relevance in your new book, Wasteland, because you focus more there on the way in which the shrinkage of the information landscape and also just of geography, I mean, the connection of every place to every other by air travel has just changed the dynamics of everything. And, you know, the institutions fraying in one part of the world affect the institutions elsewhere. But before we jump into the new book, do you still view the environmental focus you had 30 years ago as fairly central, or is it a second order concern?
No, it's fairly central, Sam, because at the time I said in The Coming Anarchy, the essay, the 1994 essay, that the environment, the natural environment, would eventually constitute the number one security issue of the 21st century. Of course, now it goes under a different name, climate change. It used to be global warming. But what we're really talking about is populations in the developing world that have not stabilized and gone down like in the West, but are still climbing. Meanwhile, there's less and less water to drink and for agriculture. There's less and less nutrients in the soil in many of these countries, which again puts more pressure on food production. So that and this leads to migration. It leads from the rural areas, which can no longer sustain agriculture, into the cities, which can no longer sustain these bulging populations. So consequently, people live in slums and shanty towns. And this goes uncovered still in the media to a significant extent because they're off our radar screen, so to speak. We don't realize that most of Africa now is urban. It's not National Geographic photo rural. It's mostly urban, and therefore these places are harder to govern, harder to satisfy, because urban populations require complex infrastructure that rural populations don't. So I would say that the natural environment, writ large, connecting with a lot of other factors, is still fairly central.
Yeah, the demographic details you cite in the book around urbanization and just population growth in Africa especially are pretty alarming. I mean, if memory serves, it's something like you're forecasting that 85% of humanity will be living in these vast megacities.
Not that high. I forget the exact figure, but look at it this way. At the beginning of the 21st century, our century now, there was one African for every one European. At the end of the 21st century, there's going to be seven Africans for every European. Europe is only separated from Africa by the Mediterranean Sea, which is fairly narrow in global terms. So we're going to have a decades ahead of more and more migration, as many of these people in sub-Saharan Africa become middle class, and in the first generation of middle class, they leave, they migrate for better opportunities elsewhere. So that this steady migration from not only Africa, from the Middle East, is going to fuel European populism for decades to come.
Well, I want to jump into that. I want to talk about the specific fates of Europe and America and Russia and China and many of these places you focus on, but let's talk about the central analogy you draw in your book to the Weimar Republic it's been pretty common, probably all too common and somewhat misleading for people to analogize between America under Trump and Weimar. That seems to sharpen up the concern about authoritarianism, perhaps to too fine a point. But you draw a global analogy. You're describing what you call a global Weimar. What do you, maybe remind people just what Weimar was and what lessons we draw from it and why you think this is a good analogy for the globe?
Right. I'm not interested in Hitler per se. When people say Weimar, they think that it ended with Hitler. It did, but that's not what concerns me with this analogy in this book. Weimar is a town in central Germany where at the end of World War I in 1918, German constitutionalists, lawyers, politicians all met to draw up a new constitution. Now, Germany had just lost World War I, millions of deaths, and that, you know, Kaiser Wilhelm II would turn out to be a disastrous autocrat. Even Bismarck, from the late 19th century ruler of Germany, was looked down upon. And the rulers of Weimar, the people who gathered at Weimar, were determined never to have another autocrat rule Germany. So what they did was, and we all do this in our lives periodically, they overlearned the lesson. They made not only it so hard for another autocrat to emerge, they made it hard to govern the place in the first place. So that there was constant crises, constantly weak governments, weak cabinets. Nobody was in control. And because nobody was in control, it led eventually to a super autocrat, to Hitler. But for me, the world today is like the 15 years of Weimar between 1918 and 1933. It's, why do I make an analogy between the world and Weimar? Weimar was so small, the world is so big, because technology has shrunk geography. It's not only the internet, social media, it's air travel, it's the unity of financial markets. We're all close to each other now. We all inhabit an anxious, claustrophobic world like Weimar was. And it's not going to lead to another Hitler. I say that, you know, I say that up front very clearly. But what it would lead to is like a permanent crisis, permanent paralysis, so to speak, that the days when the world had some coherence during the bipolar Cold War and unipolar American leadership in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War, those days are over. Now we live in a global Weimar where we're close enough to affect each other, but still there's nobody in control.
Well, on the matter of control, at one point you make in the book, and you probably make it elsewhere if memory serves, is that order must precede freedom, right? And this is something that is, I think, routinely overlooked on the left. But as you move right of center with this epiphany, you run the risk of authoritarian capture, right? I mean, if you privilege order over everything, I mean, the primacy of order leads to all kinds of, you know, right-wing temptations of a sort that we're seeing play out globally. How do we avoid this lurch toward tyranny in the face of disorder?
Yes, this was the very problem that the founders of the American Republic wrestled with. If you read the Federalist Papers, you read the debates between Hamilton and Jefferson and all of those things, you know, they were absolutely united, and they wanted to avoid tyranny, but they also were afraid of chaos, of anarchy. And the reason they were afraid of chaos and anarchy was because they had Cromwell in their backs, the English Revolution. Mm. Remember, we're talking here the 1780s or so, and their frame of reference was back to the 1700s, the 1600s. So they knew it was a fine balance. Madison said, you don't want a democracy, you want a republic. What he meant by a republic was limited democracy, where people would vote every 2 or 4 years, but otherwise elites at the top who were well-educated, you know, moral, would run the system. It was like a combination. they would be horrified at the push polls we have now of, you know, of primary elections. It would just horrify them. They would see that as a lurch towards disorder, so to speak. But order comes before freedom, because without order, there is no freedom for anybody. You know, anarchy is a word we use. Most people have never experienced it. I've experienced anarchy in Sierra Leone, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and other places. Literally, when there's nobody in control is the most frightening political reality you can think of.
Yeah. You make a related point, which I had never considered, but it strikes me as true, that when you're talking about establishing democratic order, democratic institutions are more important than democratic ideals. I mean, we tend to think about it in terms of the ideals first, but really, when you look at our, especially when you look at our failure to export democracy to the rest of the world, I mean, to go into the Middle East and, you know, our various misadventures there and try to nation build, you know, the ideals can be spread as liberally as you want, but the failure to build durable institutions just renders the whole project synonymous with failure and internecine chaos in the end.
Spot on. The great late Harvard political scientist Samuel Huntington said that America is great not because of the character of its peoples, but because of its institutions. And he didn't just mean the separation of powers in Washington between executive, legislative, and judicial. He also meant the separation of the states, the counties, and the federal government. Wherever you look, there was separation of powers, and with strong institutions at every level. So this is what made Huntington say America is a great country, because no place else has our level of separation of institutions. And so this is, you know, this is what makes America great, and it's also what makes the present moment in America so perilous. Because we're seeing these institutions challenged. We're seeing the separation of power challenged. You can have periods where you have a stronger presidency, a weaker presidency, a stronger Congress, a weaker Congress, but it stays within a certain medium, so to speak. And many countries don't have any of this. Huntington said something else. He said that America has no business lecturing the world about its systems of government, because the American form of government was, despite our revolution, was largely inherited from 17th century England. What the revolution and the Continental Congress and the Federalist Papers were all about was fine-tuning the details. We inherited our system of government from 17th century England, whereas many countries in the developing world have inherited nothing, essentially. The colonialists ruled and then they just left, so to speak. So you have many countries in the world that are starting to, that are having to build institutions from scratch, which is something we actually never had to do.
Yeah. All right, so let's take a tour of the chaos and start with Russia. So in the book, you describe Putin as the most dangerous Russian leader since Stalin. It would seem that most Americans, certainly right of center and most definitely in Trumpistan, are unaware of this. Then there's even a fondness for Putin that has spread in that cult. Why does Putin worry you more than anyone else?
Remember, when the Soviet Union... For most of the Cold War, Stalin died in 1953. So for most of the Cold War, we faced a Soviet Politburo of like 12 or 14 men. Yes, we had Soviet leaders, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, Andropov, etc., but they were merely spokesmen for the Politburo. So there was collegial rule, collegial leadership. And this Politburo, though technically communist, was in fact deeply cautious and conservative. And why do I say that? Because the only way to, they were all survivors of Stalin's purges of the 1930s and 1940s. How do you survive Stalin's purges? You have an opinion on nothing, essentially. You're overly cautious. You never open your mouth. And that's who essentially ruled the Soviet Union through most of the Cold War. So we had it easy in a way. Putin is not like this at all. Putin is a risk taker. He governs alone, essentially. Around him are various circles of oligarchs, of crime figures, of intelligence figures, of the media. If Putin were to get sick tomorrow, it's unclear who would rule Russia. Russia could descend into a kind of low-calorie version of the former Yugoslavia in the 1990s. So Putin is very, very dangerous. And the most dangerous and also the strongest Russian leader since Stalin died in 1953.
And what's the significance of the war in Ukraine, in your view, and what did it reveal about Russia?
It revealed Russian weakness, really. Because remember the day before the Ukraine war started in early February 2022, Russia was assumed to be able to conquer Ukraine in short order, send in a bunch of tank divisions, you know, various arrow points on the map of tanks rolling in. Because look at it, from the point of view of early February 2022, Russia had essentially won the war in Syria. It had made deep inroads in sub-Saharan Africa. It made deep inroads in the Caucasus, in the greater Balkans, in Transdniestria and other places. Russia seemed invincible, both to us and to Putin. The lesson Putin learned from those small wars was wars can be easy. You can win easily, so to speak. But then he made the fateful decision to invade Ukraine, and it was revealed that in a great power military operation, Russia had no logistics. You know, there's a saying that amateurs discuss strategy and professionals discuss logistics. Mm-hmm. Big military operations are logistics, logistics, logistics. In other words, it's not just the tanks. It's the maintenance crews that have to be alongside them. It's the food wagons that have to be alongside them to feed the soldiers. It's the laundry people. It's all kinds of things have to accompany your main fighting units in the, you know, relatively in coordination. And it turned out that Russia had none of this. It just had none of this. It could fake it in small-scale military operations in Syria, which was mainly an air war from the Russian point of view, and in various places in sub-Saharan West Africa. But the Ukraine war revealed Russian weakness. So we have a country, Ukraine, a big country of 44 million people, but still just one country that has been able to withstand the might of the Russian war machine for like almost 4 years now.
So what's at stake there? What do you think is likely to happen? And what do you think the likely consequences are of it happening?
I think Russia's a country in decline, really. And I think that, remember, World War I changed the 20th century because it went on for four long years. The Ukraine war is in its fourth year. We'll celebrate the fourth anniversary, or rather not celebrate the fourth anniversary in February, which is very close. And it has changed Russia. It's made it more brittle, more militaristic, poorer. Russia can no longer dictate events in the Caucasus, in former Soviet Central Asia, in Siberia, in the Siberian republics, in the Russian Far East. In other words, the Russian Empire is what we're talking about. Mm. Russia's ability to project power into its own empire because of the ongoing drain of the Ukraine war gets weaker and weaker and weaker. So I think the historical result of the Ukraine war, when it's over, or even while it still is going on, is going to be we're going to be faced with a weak Russia. And or maybe a Russia without Putin, and that will be more dangerous given Russia's nuclear arsenal than Russia with Putin.
Do you think there's risk of Russia going after other European states like Poland or Latvia and Lithuania. And I mean, is that in the cards, or do you think the revealed weakness of the Russian military has more or less closed the door to those possibilities?
There is a risk because of the evolution of military hardware. You know, you have drones, you have cyber attacks, you have various unconventional means that Russia could exert to destabilize, you know, Europe proper. Mm. But in terms of an actual military invasion of Europe, I think that's been overrated, so to speak. Mm. Russia has its hands full in Ukraine.
So what does all this do to nuclear deterrence? You just flag that nuclear risk goes up, certainly in the aftermath of a totally fragmented Russia with no line of succession after Putin. What's the, you know, I last left in my memory, you know, Sam Nunn organizing the segregation of all the loose nukes in the former Soviet Union. What is our nuclear future there?
Well, I think over the last 20 or 30 years, what we've learned is that nuclear weapons work. They can be used. They have been used. Well, what do I mean by that? We've seen no nuclear explosion since Hiroshima in 1945. What I mean is nuclear weapons are traditionally used as a form of coercion or a form of national prestige, intimidation. Merely by saying, by the way, we have nuclear weapons, this might very well have made former President Biden much more cautious in arming Ukraine than he normally would have been. We'll find out more about this when the memoirs are published of the Biden administration. North Korea has nukes. They have 60-odd nuclear weapons, apparently. Nobody's attacking North Korea. Gaddafi gave up his weapons of mass destruction. The West engineered an invasion of Libya. Ukraine gave up its nukes at the end of the Cold War, and that weakened Ukraine. If Ukraine had kept a few nukes, Putin may never have invaded Ukraine in the first place. Mm. And then you have the standoff between India and Pakistan, both with substantial amounts of nukes. So nuclear weapons are part, very much a part of great power calculations today, even though they can't actually be used. I mean, they don't fit into the Western doctrine of war. It's a big jump to go from conventional weapons to nuclear weapons. What makes the United States a great power, much more than its nuclear weapons, is its Navy. It's the U.S. Navy is America's great strategic advantage.
Mm. Well, we'll talk about the implications for any great power conflict with China there. All right, so let's talk about Europe. What are the implications for Europe? I guess just moving directly from the war in Ukraine, but then let's talk about the other pressures. I mean, you've already raised the issue of migration and the knock-on effects of right-wing populism, which I want to talk about. I mean, if you look at my YouTube algorithm, it looks like the UK, at least, is unraveling culturally in response to immigration and populism. I don't know how distorted all that is.
No, it's not very distorted at all.
So, yeah, what's your view of Europe?
The UK is unraveling not just culturally, but politically. The current prime minister, Keir Starmer, if there were an election held tomorrow, he might get just 10% of the vote. Mm. You know, the real strength is in this outlying party led by Nigel Farage, which is basically wants to deport immigrants in mass, so to speak.
Yeah.
The UK won't have a civil war. It's far too divided for that, but it could have a kind of low-level anarchy in the years to come. Because if you look at the UK, Sam, if you look at France under Macron, if you look at Germany under Friedrich Merz, less so Germany, but more so France and the UK, you see the power of the right wing to essentially erode away the center. And the power of the right wing is mainly about a fear of migration. Mm. You know, that's what it's really about. You know, people said the extreme German right wing party, the AfD, is anti-Semitic. No, that's not what it's about. It's really anti-immigrant. That's what it's about. And that's why the AfD and the right wing in France have actually been pro-Israel in this recent war. It's not because they like Israel, but it's a reflection of their anti-Muslim immigrant base, essentially. So look at Europe. Europe has the Ukraine and the potential unraveling Russia on the east. It has migration in the south. It has migration in the southeast from a greater Middle East where there's still a lot of instability. It has no oceans on each side of it. It's not like us, where our only challenging border is to the south. We have two oceans on each side. We have a Canadian middle class to the north of us. Essentially, we're in good shape, despite how we tear ourselves apart. But Europe could really go through some unraveling, because it's mainly been the center right and the center left, that have successfully governed Europe throughout the Cold War and much of the post-Cold War. That center is shredding, it's weakening, it's diluting, and we're seeing a harder right and a harder left in all of these European democracies.
How do you explain the fact that Europe has so totally mishandled immigration and assimilation? I mean just the naivete with which Angela Merkel thought they could absorb, you know, virtually everyone coming out of the Syrian civil war. I'll put my cards on the table. I mean, my audience will be familiar with this, but in case you're unfamiliar with my views on this, you know, I have zero sympathy, as should be obvious, for the racist concerns of xenophobes and bigots who don't want dark-skinned people coming into their country. However, I am all too sympathetic with concerns about fanatical adherence to Islam, right? You know, we call them Islamists and jihadists. I'm increasingly worried that those are functioning like euphemisms, because I do think that just merely plain vanilla conservative Muslims pose certain problems of assimilation in Western countries as well. How is it that the center or the center left or even the center right has failed to understand that you can't absorb an unlimited number of people into your society who may still have a fondness for living under Sharia law?
Yes. Look, Angela Merkel allowed in 1 million extra migrants into Germany so she could be the Time magazine's Woman of the Year. Remember, admitting an unlimited number of migrants into Germany was a popular elite media point of view back in the day. They said Germany would show its concern for humanity, it would erase the stigma of the Holocaust, all of that. What they never considered, and what Merkel as a politician had to consider but didn't, was how this demographic shift might destabilize Germany and make Germans more extreme. And it was because of that, and because she misread Vladimir Putin, despite growing up in East Germany and speaking Russian, that she's looked back upon as a worse and worse chancellor, essentially. I think, look, Europe, as I said earlier, is close to the Middle East. It's close to Africa. It's close to a lot of these places. It was always going to be more challenged by migration than the United States, for instance, or Canada or other places. But it's mishandled it because the elites, especially the liberal elites, did not factor in sufficiently how, you know, allowing in masses of migrants from different and various cultures would upset social stability in their countries, that their voters only had a limited degree. Once it made life more complex and difficult for voters, there was going to be a revolt. And the European elites did not factor this in, because that was not their world. They lived in an elite world where they themselves and their children were not threatened by immigrants. But people living in lower middle class housing and, you know, cheek to jowl with migrants and their gangs and their needs, couldn't face. The best example of this is Holland. You know, Holland is has really faced a right-wing movement that has changed Dutch politics, because of the effect of migration on such a small country.
Yeah. Well, I remember my friend Ayaan Hirsi Ali run out of Holland based on her security concerns.
Yeah.
There was a moment there where she's a member of parliament being hunted by Islamist theocrats within Holland, and the government couldn't figure out how to keep her safe, and they literally put her in a prison for 3 months as the solution to her security problems. All right, so a lot of this chaos is being exported from the Middle East, if not physically, certainly by virtue of the spread of certain ideas.
And it's also, not only that, but it also, just always remember that the people talk about a declining birth rate and how, you know, the world population is going to cease growing in about 30 or 40 years. That's a great general statement. But when you look at the specific facts around it, the footnotes, what you see is that populations are still growing substantially in the poorest parts of the world, in sub-Saharan Africa, in Yemen especially, in the Middle East. And this is what leads ultimately to the migration we've been talking about.
Mm. All right. So how do you view events specifically in the Middle East? I mean, we should probably focus on October 7th and its aftermath, the war in Gaza, the bombing of Iran, the ceasefire, the Abraham Accords. Where is all this heading in your view?
Well, if you look at it historically, the results of the Gaza war are not that different from the results of some previous Middle Eastern wars. What happened going back to 1948 is that the Israelis are content with like a third of Palestine, but the Arabs say, no, that's too much. So they fight a war and the Arabs lose, you know, and they lose 20%, another 20% of Palestine. You look at the Six-Day War. What was the result? The Israelis took Gaza, they took the West Bank, they took the Golan Heights. Then you look at the 1973 war, and despite initial setbacks, the Israeli military found itself halfway to Cairo from the Suez Canal and partway to Damascus from within artillery range of Damascus from the Golan Heights. And then you see the end of this war. After 2 years of fighting, the Arabs, the Palestinians, whatever, have lost even more territory. You know, Israel is holding, I think, about 30% of Gaza as a buffer. I don't know the exact percentage, but you can bet your life they're never giving that up. Mm. You know, that's gone. And then over the last 2 years, though it's been a page two and page three story, has been the steady accumulation of Jewish sovereignty in the West Bank, which the Israeli government promoted precisely because of October 7th, 2023. So, you know, the Arabs keep losing territory. And I wrote in Wasteland. I finished writing it in 2024 early. And I wrote in the book that October 7th changed Israeli strategic calculus. It was willing to take risks and suffer civilian collateral damage to the degree that it didn't before. And the result would lead, perhaps, to an Israeli attack on Iran and an American helping. That happened. That's already happened. Mm. If you look at all these forgettable leaders of Western Europe, Starmer in Britain, Macron in France, all of them, they're all forgettable. In 20, 30 years, nobody will recall their names. But Benjamin Netanyahu, they will be writing big, thick biographies about 50 years from now. You know, we live in the age of Netanyahu. Look at what he's done. You know, on October 7th, 2023, Hezbollah ruled Lebanon, Hamas ruled Gaza. The Iranians had a growing, massive nuclear weapons program. Much of that is gone. You know, they basically decimated Hezbollah. They basically decimated Hamas. And they've given a lethal, they've destroyed Iran's air defense system. They've done significant damage to its nuclear program. So only Netanyahu could have done this. Yes, Israel has other talented leaders and other talented generals who are politicians, like Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot and others. But none of them had the political skills to essentially manipulate Donald Trump into joining the war against Iran the way that Netanyahu did. And in fact, to attack Iran while negotiations were still going on. That was the big surprise of the Israeli attack on Iran. Many of Iran's leaders thought they were safe for another week or so while negotiations were going on, and that's when Netanyahu chose to attack. So we're dealing here, like it or not, love him or hate him, with a real historical figure who will be remembered for decades, maybe centuries to come, regardless of what happens through the rest of his career.
Yeah. I share your view that he has been masterful in maintaining a relationship with Trump, whose volatility and impulsivity are hard to exaggerate. Let's just take a quick sidebar around Iran. What do you think the implications are for Iran? I mean, Iran was revealed to, I think, everyone's surprise to be far more vulnerable than expected. What's the prospect for regime change there, do you think? I mean, do you think there's enough of appetite for a change from theocracy among the general population that the regime is actually vulnerable to having been unmasked as a paper tiger?
Well, look, I'm 73. I remember when the Shah was in power. And I remember all these experts saying that there will always be a Shah in Iran. That the idea of another kind of regime was just impossible to imagine. Experts could analyze it happening, but people couldn't actually imagine it. Then, poof, one day the Shah was gone. This is like 45 years ago. And we had a new regime, the regime of the Ayatollahs. Now it's hard, because it's gone on for so long, almost half a century, it's hard for people to imagine a new Iran. But there will be a day when there will be no Ayatollahs ruling Iran, just as a day came when the Shah was no longer ruling Iran. I would say we're much closer to the end of the regime than we were before October 7th, 2023. Let me take you back to the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. It had a devastating, traumatic effect on Iran's leadership at the time, because the war was fought on Iranian soil. And Iran's Ayatollahs, who were new in power, were determined that Iran's future wars would not be fought on its soil. It would project power. So it created Hezbollah. It created Hamas. And it created the Houthis in Yemen. And it built the nuclear deterrent so that any bloodshed would not be in Iran. All those things are gone, or almost gone. So the regime is weaker now than it's ever been in decades, and probably weaker than at any time since right after the revolution, when it was still very fragile. But nevertheless, you have to say, people were talking about the end of the Ottoman Empire in the 1850s, but the Ottoman Empire did not collapse until 1922, and that was as a result of World War I. So that just because Iran's leadership is weak and fragile doesn't mean it can't linger on for some years to come. But I think we're going to see a new Iran sometime in 5 years. If you were to ask me in 6 or 7 years, will this regime be governing Iran in the same way that it is governing it now, I would say no.
Is there anything that fundamentally surprised you in the aftermath of October 7th? You know, many of us were surprised by the extent and depth of the anti-Semitism we saw and are still seeing expressed globally. Did that surprise you? And if not that, anything else?
No, I always have been worried more for years and years about anti-Semitism on the left than on the right. You know, it exists in both places, but the left, it became a factor of identity politics. There was a book written in the 1990s by a former New York Times book reviewer, Richard Bernstein, and the book was called The Tyranny of Virtue, or The Dictatorship of Virtue. And it was about how campuses throughout the United States were elevating identity politics to such an extreme that it would become very dangerous. You know, you put identity politics together with traditional leftism, and you have fertile ground for anti-Semitism. Because identity politics basically works against Jews and against Asians, essentially. So that didn't really surprise me so much. But I want to get back to something I said before and just give another factoid, yeah, so to speak. October 7th so traumatized the Israeli state security military machine that they suddenly became willing to allow for more collateral damage and civilian casualties. If you're going to attack a high-value target in the United States, say a terrorist target, Obama did, you know, Obama especially took out a lot of high-value terrorist targets with drones, and you're going to have collateral damage of, say, 40 civilians or 25 civilians, that's a decision that goes right to the White House. Nobody in the Pentagon can make that decision. Mm-hmm. It goes right to the president's desk. Well, you had that level of collateral damage being decided upon by Israeli colonels and generals. It didn't even have to go to Netanyahu, essentially. That's how October 7th changed Israeli calculus. And I think that what we're going to see in the future is we're going to see essentially a greater Israel, where Israel will hold on to 30, 40% of Gaza, will hold on to most of the West Bank, and there'll be a corresponding reasonable level of anti-Semitism that will remain in the West permanently.
Mm. I think I need to double-click on that concept of a reasonable level of anti-Semitism. What is striking you as reasonable?
I mean, staying where it is now.
Mm.
You know, and by reasonable, it could, of course, get much worse, but I don't think it will. You know, there's a lot I don't like about President Trump, a lot. I think, you know, he's a danger to the Constitution, to the separation of powers. But I think his attack on the elite universities, while overblown and going too far, may ultimately have a positive effect. Mm. You know, it may bring them back from the brink.
Yeah, I actually share that, all the misgivings and also the perception of a silver lining there. What is your view of the future, the likely future of Israel? I assume you think that any notion of a two-state solution is not even a figment of anyone's imagination at this point.
No, look, anything is possible, you know, of course. And you could have a kind of enhanced Abraham Accords with Saudi Arabia joining the Gulf Arab states and normalizing relations with Israel. And in return, the Saudis would be able to force the Israelis to give them some limited sovereignty to half of the population of Gaza, the West Bank. All that is generally possible. But I think there's a larger historical cultural movement going on, which is in the early days of Israel, up from 48 to after the 1967 war, the West was very comfortable with Israel. It liked Israel when Israel was governed by center-left kibbutzniks who were also fighter pilots when they were in the military. These were not traditional Jews, so to speak. They were Israelis. There was something new and different about them. And the West was comfortable with that. But I think Israel has become and is still becoming less Israeli and more Jewish because of demographics inside Israel itself. And so Israel will be more permanently right-wing, even if governments oscillate here and there. It will become more religious, and the West will be less comfortable with that.
Hmm. Okay, so let's make a leap to the Pacific. What's in the offing for our great power, our emerging great power conflict with China, military buildup in the Pacific? You have Japan and Australia, our allies becoming more concerned about conflict with China. What's your crystal ball say about that region of the earth?
Well, I think now you've hit upon the most important part of the world. And let me explain what I mean about that. It's been impressive the way that financial markets have priced in wars in Ukraine, in the Middle East. We could all argue and have different opinions about Ukraine, about Gaza, but it has not affected our retirement statements that we get every month or whenever we check online. If you had, though, a war in the Pacific, a high-end conflict lasting just a week or two between the United States and China with the use of submarines, missiles, and bringing in Japan, because Japan is part of this mix. Remember, Japan governed Taiwan for 50 years from 1890 to 1940. You would have a global economic catastrophe. You could really have a real destabilization of markets, because then you would have, in the Pacific, you would have the world's top three economies fighting a war with each other over the most important sea lines of communications and over the most important supply chains in the world. And this would dramatically affect our retirement accounts, the stock market, and we would be in a different world. It would be, if there's anything that's analogous to how World War I changed humanity culturally and economically, it would be a war in the Pacific. Now, I think that this is precisely, here's the silver lining, here's precisely what prevents such a war. It's that leaders in Washington, in Beijing, in Tokyo, without ever mentioning it publicly, are aware of what I've just said. Hmm. You know, they would just be nodding their heads. And that's why they all want to avoid such a conflict. It's kind of analogous to the way that hydrogen bombs kept the peace in Europe during the Cold War. And especially after the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was this fear that, yes, nuclear war was actually very possible. So it was after the Cuban Missile Crisis that you got hotlines, strategic arms limitation talks, test ban treaties, and ultimately detente. So I think that what's keeping the peace in the Pacific is precisely the knowledge that a war there, through a miscalculation of some sort, would change our lives in a way that nothing in the Middle East or Ukraine has been able to do.
Isn't there an asymmetry with which our lives would change? Because there's a kind of demographic time bomb in China already ticking down. It seems to me they could get to a situation where they have much less to lose, and internal chaos and unhappiness could be profitably pointed outside the country to a Western adversary.
Well, that's history.
Yeah.
I mean, history shows that wars often start when regimes are in trouble domestically, you know, and regimes are challenged domestically. So that, you know, what you just said is quite true.
What do you think the likelihood of our losing a war with China would be? I mean, they sort of have a home court advantage geographically.
They do. Yeah.
Are we confident that we would win a naval engagement in the South China Sea?
I don't think we're that confident, because in many of the Pentagon war games that they continually hold, we end up losing.
Mm.
You know, and that really scares the daylights out of people. And when people are scared, they do something about it, essentially. So I don't think we're all that arrogant or confident that we would win a war with China. As you said, China does have a home court advantage. You know, we're in the position of having to project power around the globe, or have been, whereas China just has to project power in the Western Pacific, essentially, to defeat us. And that really gives them an advantage. But if you look at it the other way, if China were to lose, you know, I often say it's easy to start a war in the Pacific, but how do you end it? How does it end?
Mm.
Does it end with the collapse of the communist regime in China that leads to chaos inside China? Does it end with the permanent decline of the United States? Because if we lose a war against China, we can no longer protect our markets in the Western Pacific the way we used to. And the Western Pacific is really the first among equals in terms of economic gravity in the world.
Mm. So what do you think would happen if China invaded Taiwan at this point? I mean, is there any chance we would follow through on the implications of our strategic ambiguity and actually defend Taiwan at this point?
Yeah, well, strategic ambiguity is held up since Nixon-Kissinger. That's a long time in diplomatic history. And let me just, what is strategic ambiguity is that we recognize there is only one China and it's in Beijing, but neither party should do anything to militarily change the status quo. And that was a good formula, and it worked for 50 years. It would depend, Sam, on how they attack Taiwan. If they were to do things like to take out their electricity grid, freeze their internet, have a blockade, there could be a ruinous debate in Washington and around the country saying, it's not our war, maybe we shouldn't do anything about it. But if they were to suddenly frontally attack Taiwan, there would be more of a likelihood for a sudden American military response, regardless of what President Trump may or may not have said the week before.
Okay, so this brings us to America. We have, so you wrote your book when Biden was in charge. And so maybe we should just close the loop on what you think Biden's legacy as a president with respect to these issues might be. But then let's discuss your view of Trump's America as well.
All right. In terms of Biden, I think he was a weak president who paved the way for a second Trump administration. That's how he will be looked at. He was a weak president not because of the people he appointed. He appointed some first-rate people. Jake Sullivan as National Security Advisor, William Burns as head of the CIA, and on were all top-of-the-line technocrats, essentially. He was a weak president because even with a government, national security apparatus of top-of-the-line technocrats, you still need a strong president who makes decisive decisions. That's just the way our system works. And Biden was not like that. He was fading. He was losing mojo, whatever you want to call it. And so I think Biden will go down as a weak, overly cautious president at this stage. In terms of Trump's America, I would put it this way, that what we've lost is the center. There's still a narrow center which decides elections, but we used to be governed by a center-right, business-like Republican Party full of competent people at all levels, and a center-left, liberal, Democratic Party that kept away from extremes and was also filled with competent people to run things when they got into power. And because the center ruled, we had a coherent Congress. We had center-right and center-left senators and representatives from both parties essentially continually making deals, which kept the government running and allowed for good policy. The Civil Rights Act, the 1986 Tax Reform Act, these were products of the center, essentially. And the center has been lost. I'll explain why in a minute. But with the center lost, you now have a populist right-wing Republican Party and a progressive hard left-wing Democratic Party. And when everyone moves to the extremes, elections become, to use an overused College Board word, existential. You know, they're life and death, so to speak. Because your opponent is not just slightly on the other side of you, he's way on the other side of you, and you cannot tolerate that. And that leads to bad government, an immobilized Congress, the current shutdown, etc. Why has the center been so weakened? I would say two reasons. One is globalization itself. Globalization was supposed to unite the world. That's what everyone said in the 1990s. But what happened was something more complex. Globalization split societies down the middle. It split us down the middle. It split the UK down the middle. It split France down the middle. In our case, it meant, and I'm exaggerating and generalizing here to make a point, it led to a kind of whiskey and wine sipping, European vacation oriented, very sophisticated, upper middle class, globalized, and a lower middle class and poor people who could not compete, who could not take part in the various benefits of globalization. So it split the society down the middle, and that hurt the center. And then there's technology itself. Remember, the United States was a very coherent, impressive mass democracy in the greater print and typewriter age. Essentially, from the American Revolution with its pamphleteering and Federalist Papers all the way to the late 20th century, when the media was essentially a print media composed of long articles, all fact-checked, all written from a slightly liberal, in most cases, conservative in lesser cases, but mainly a centrist point of view. And this media affected government and the population. You got coherent leadership, coherent decisions. But in a digital video social media age, you get extremes, because social media is about passion. It's about brevity. And passion is the enemy of analysis, essentially. And you need analysis to essentially govern. It simplifies everything, dangerously so. Remember, I said at the beginning of our conversation about how James Madison wanted a republic, not a democracy. What he meant, translated to our current situation, is that we were essentially a republic as long as the party leaders, the party bosses, decided who would run in presidential elections. And that worked very well. The party bosses picked Harry Truman in the smoke-filled rooms to be an ailing president, Franklin Roosevelt's vice president, and on and on. Well, that system died, and the primaries took over. If we still had the party boss system in 2016, Donald Trump never would have been the Republican nominee. The nominee would have been Jeb Bush, who would have governed like his father, not like his brother, would have been boring, would have been very competent, and that's how it would have been. But that America is gone, and it's not coming back. And technology and globalization has created this current crisis with President Trump.
Okay, well, let's close on the phrase you just spoke, which is still ringing in everyone's ears, that it's not coming back. Why are you confident about that? I mean, I could make the case for, I mean, it might require some unignorable signs that we have moved too close to the brink, right? Just some economic calamity, or he's bumping into some other hard object out there in the you know, whether we're still in the reality-based community or not, there's still a reality out there that we have to navigate,
yeah.
And
well,
we're going to bump into some hard objects. So you don't think we might come to our senses? I mean, so just, let's look at this through the lens of the Democrats and the Republicans. Don't you think the Democrats at this point are at least capable of pulling back from the brink of leftist identity politics, wokist lunacy, and promoting someone, you know, as early as the midterms, but certainly by 2028, who's got his or her head screwed on straight and is not a identitarian socialist maniac? And don't you think in a post-Trump situation, the Republicans are capable of looking in the mirror and realizing they've become a personality cult, and it is odious, and they have a lot to apologize for, and now we need something far more normal happening right of center in American politics?
That's possible. When I look at the Democrats, I see one centrist, liberal, highly competent, technocratic Democrat who wants to be president, Rahm Emanuel. But outside of elites like us, nobody knows his name, you know? What is more likely is that a Democratic primary season would elevate people like Elizabeth Warren and somebody maybe like Gavin Newsom, who's not as dangerous as Elizabeth Warren, you know, who's not as dangerous. He's more normal, so to speak. It would depend upon the candidate. I would say a normal America, as you speak of, would come back with a Rahm Emanuel as president. But as I said, nobody knows his name outside of us and people who read the op-ed pages, so to speak. On the Republican side, I think that it's most likely that someone like J.D. Vance will follow Trump. anything is possible. We spoke earlier about how a war with China would change America, would change the world. You know, that could be the wake-up call. Anything is possible in America. America has reinvented itself during the populist, the progressive era, you know, with the end of the founding father elites in the early 19th century when Andrew Jackson replaced John Quincy Adams. It reinvented itself during the progressive era of the late 19th century when Woodrow Wilson incorporated many of the progressive values of William Jennings Bryan without going over the cliff into Bryan's extreme. So it's possible, but we deal with probabilities. And that's why it's to me, it's likely that there's no going back to what we had before.
So we're just going to have one game show host after another running this country?
Who knows?
Robert Kaplan, the book is Wasteland, A World in Permanent Crisis. Thank you so much for your time, Robert. It's been a great education.
Thank you very much for having me, Sam.